All right, so we've got Ramon joining us just now, which is going to be very exciting. You know Ramon as well. He's had to keep a low profile because he's going after some money that the government owe him for hiring him and then unceremoniously firing him.
So what the fuck's he doing here then?
Let me bring him on. Is he there? Ramon, you on? Hello.
Yeah, good morning, everyone. I am here indeed.
Dude, you look very, very relaxed and very happy and young and vital. You don't look miserable and old and tormented by the government like I thought you might. I haven't seen you in like a year.
When your enemies keep making mistakes, you just carry on with life, you know?
or you just let them.
Yes, quite. I mean, what could have been great, but you know, people make decisions and now they can be hoisted by their own petard, as we say.
I'm going to say nice things to you at the start of this because I'll probably end up taking the piss out of you for the rest of this discussion. And we've got lots to talk about besides you. But you are the only one of the people I know quite well who's actually volunteered to do public service and to go and work for government. And I think that deserves some credit. I would never work for government. Ben would never do it, right, Ben?
Can't. No, I wouldn't. No.
So you were ready to do the service, man.
Yeah, you're missing out. I mean, I came out of nowhere, firstly. And this is misapprehension. I was a member of the DA, that I was, I don't know, I went through the ranks or something like that. Complete nonsense. I was called randomly to come become the chief of staff to the Minister of Agriculture. I said yes without hesitation. It took many weeks to get there with like psychometric testing and a variety of other things. I lost a lot of money because I had to leave everything else to do it. And then, once I got there, it just became a bit untenable. But while it lasted, it's actually a lot of fun. If you bring sort of energy to it, it's an amazing place to be.
I mean, our mutual friend Jonathan Witt said, and I kind of concur with him on this, that if John Steenhuisen had kept you as chief of staff instead of that chick who fucked up so badly 2 weeks ago and pissed off all the Dutchmen, if he'd kept you, he would probably still be Minister of Agriculture and he wouldn't have screwed up the foot and mouth problem as badly as he did. Bitcoin Butt has a question for you, though. You don't have to comment on that. By the way, what is the status quo with your government, your case against them? Have they settled? Have they made an arrangement with you? Is it still in play?
No. So we finalized arguments 2 weeks ago Friday. In the what's called the bargaining council. So I'm a bit screwed because John has left his portfolio now. So my compensation is very limited to his time. So I know that there's a figure of 5 million being bandied about. That was just a 5-year contract that I wanted, which I was entitled to. Well, I would have argued I would be entitled to it. But now that he's been demoted, I'm limited to the time that he was there as minister, because I would have automatically left the post.
So because of this fuck up now, you're in for less money.
Correct.
Oh, that doesn't seem fair.
That's not fair, but we will see. We expect judgments before the end of the month. What is interesting is that they brought an advocate to argue this case in the equivalent of the CCMA. So they really don't want to pay or reinstate me. I mean, I don't
know. It's so funny that they're reluctant to pay you, but we have how many people, police chiefs, deputy ministers, people who've directors general who have been suspended on full pay and who have made massive claims against the government. I mean, I don't know what the number is, but I'm pretty sure that we taxpayers are in hock for hundreds of millions of rands for people who are just not working for the state anymore. And we're still paying them, right? But they don't want to pay you.
It's billions of rands a year that we pay to people who are suspended. I mean, even at the Madlanga Commission, I mean, the one woman got a butt lift from like a gangster, right? And she was his girlfriend. I was suspended with pay. I'm like, listen, I'm the only white guy who got fired in 30 years from the government who hasn't been suspended with full pay. There's something going on here. Some would call it racism, but it seems a bit weird how swiftly I was excommunicated compared to everyone else.
Yeah, they just ignored you, right? They just went like radio silent and pretended you didn't exist. But Bitcoin Boot asks a very good question, and I don't know why the producers took it off the screen, but question for Ramon, what was John's favorite pie flavor?
And I've did never you seen have eat a pie?
And did you have to buy them?
No. I never seen him eat a pie, to be fair.
But you've seen the crumbs.
All right, Ramon.
This is an obvious case, Gareth.
I think either he's frozen or he's not going to say anything. But I think maybe his internet connection's been interrupted.
I think his lawyer just pulled the plug of his internet. Ramon, this isn't what we need right now.
Yeah, he is a lawyer. Look, he's frozen. He is a lawyer. He should have pulled his own plug then.
Yes.
Harmin says he eats it in secret in his car before and after work.
Exactly. He car pies. You know, like you used to car ball back in the day because you couldn't afford the drinks in the club? He car pies.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
this is what the interview Robin needs right now in his life.
Can you imagine that car with the beef and onion pie that's been heated in the microwave? That, the smell of the beef, back of that car.
That warm beef and onion smell. Oh.
I don't know why he froze, but we'll get him back on.
Gareth, yeah? I know you're in Ramon, you're going to get quite deep into some yes. things that I don't think I can add huge value to, so I'm going to drop off at some stage.
That's fine. I'll see you in Pretoria tomorrow.
No, I mean, obviously I'm going to chat with you until he comes back, because he might not come back. Maybe he's been pulled.
No, he's back.
Sorry, the SSA are on the call.
Yeah, definitely. Although they would fuck that up. I mean, I don't know what the quality of a national intelligence agency is. I don't believe they would know how to do this.
So I had a 6-hour interview with them while I was there. Well, for the security clearance, right? So they go through your entire history and written notes. I don't know how effective that is. I had to take a polygraph test while I was there as well. And nice people, but I wouldn't be too concerned. If I was a malevolent actor, I wouldn't be too concerned.
All right, Ben, we will see you on the show in the next couple of days. Have an excellent weekend.
Yeah, see you tomorrow in Pretoria. Ramon, have a wonderful weekend. Love you, seeing you again.
Good to see you, Ben. Have a good one.
All right, ciao Karpinski. Yeah, it's nice to have you on the show again, Ramon. I mean, we speak often, but I haven't seen you in ages, and you've obviously been through a really interesting couple of months, years now, ongoing. I mean, I kind of feel that people want your side of the story. You haven't exactly been demure about it. It's not like you're hiding anything. It's not like you've got anything to hide. But is there any relationship between you and the minister or anything else in that ministry, now deputy minister? Do you talk at all, apart from trying to get this settlement done for your firing? It wasn't really even a firing. They just kind of ignored you. They just stopped talking to you, right?
Yeah. So they normally for many, many months, and then they found a loophole that terminated my contract. And that's the loophole we took on review in the bargaining council. So, no, I mean, the last time he spoke to me was September the 10th, 2024. So I was appointed in August the 7th, on August 7th. The 6 weeks of just like hectic work, almost 2 weeks in China at a state visit. As I came back from China on the Saturday, the Monday morning, I get the email that, oh, listen, I had a terrible federal council meeting. This is not fair to you, et cetera. But I think let's find a way for you to have a dignified exit. After that, I saw him the next day, very briefly. And then nothing from him, at least. And the consternation was that he says, the department will be in touch for an HR process. And I said, great, I'll wait for it. I was ready to go, but there needs to be a process. I'm not just going to resign. I've gave up quite a lot to be here, right? And it just never happened. It just never happened. And until May of 2025, so from September to May of 2025, not a single word from the minister. I spoke to other staff members, of course, because I was the chief of staff. I had to sign off on many things. I was responsible for many things. But I was told not to go to meetings, not to go to on any trips, speak to anyone in the department or the industry. So it felt sort of like being suspended, but I used to go to the office and there was nothing to do. And then I would go home waiting for the so-called HR process to start, and it never did. And then in May of 2025, so close to, 10 months later, I get the letter like, oh, the security agency says that you can't get top secret security clearance, so therefore tell us why we shouldn't fire you, in so many words. And I responded. I said, well, the reasons that you think about it are incorrect. There's no resolutive condition in my contract, etc. And then he says, oh, thanks. I've taken everything into consideration. You're terminated. Bye. And that letter, the termination letter, these people rocked up to my house, 5 of them from the department. They came in, they took my computer, they took everything from the department's side, boom, and left, just like that. It was pretty sudden. No process, no hearing, no nothing else. And and that's the basis of the case that we have, that we've just concluded and hopefully will win. But yeah, it was 9-10 months of silence, which is the worst weird thing, because you don't know what that was going
when
on.
When did they stop paying you?
The day they find me on my birthday, 2025. June 2025.
So, you know, the government always talks about unfair labor practices, and we know how onerous it is in this country when it comes to hiring and firing people, because you've got to jump through all these loopholes. It seems that they're not prepared to jump through those loopholes themselves. And again, I only bring this up because you're the only person I know well enough to be able to ask these questions about, like, government employment. How can you be such a hypocrite that the government themselves treat their own employees at a senior level? I mean, a chief of staff is not some office lackey, you know?
No.
It seems to me like it's very hypocritical. So people mustn't think that, and by the way, I don't think that all government employees get the kind of cold shoulder that you got. I think you especially got treated badly. And by the way, I've got to say, you don't have to comment on this if you don't want to, but I think that the biggest reason that John and the DA and government in general were pressured to get rid of you was because of leftists on social media and people who had an axe to grind with you from stuff that was wholly unrelated to your job. It just seemed to me to be asinine as a reason to get rid of somebody who actually could have provided enormous value to the people of South Africa, to the agriculture ministry. I was pissed off about it. I still am pissed off about it. Clearly, you're not.
No, I was for a very long time. But you know, after a while, you just have to carry on with life. So my life is much better now. I sort of started a new business sort of almost immediately, and it's doing rather well. So I carry
on. Are you consulting to the DA like Tony Leon does?
No, well, Tony Leon also, I mean, listen, Tony Leon was instrumental in getting me fired as well.
Really? And tell people about that, because I don't think a lot of people know how influential Tony Leon still is in the DA, and maybe some other people. I mean, the DA has come under scrutiny long since you were dismissed from your position, and they've caused a lot of their own shit. I mean, John Steenhuisen the other day was talking about Jordan Hill Lewis and hyenas in the party. There's a lot of talk about Ryan Kutsia and how much influence he has on things. I'm a massive fan of Hill and Zilla, but I can honestly tell you the DA is a party. There are some awful people in that party. I'm not going to say which ones I like and which I don't, because we'll save that for a show where things are moving slowly. But you were just the first domino to fall, and now it seems like they're taking everyone with them as they leave the room.
Yeah, I'm quite agnostic on politics in general. Now that once you've been in it, you can see how soul destroying and how soul crushing it is. So just think of John Steenhuisen. The guy started there at the age of 22, I think, or 20.
Yeah.
He's been in that party, now he's almost 50, I think. And I saw the average week as a minister and as like the DA leader. This guy took 4 to 6 flights a week, traveling to all different parts of the country, talking at this meeting at this farmer's thing, traveling overseas for 5 days to do this, coming back, going straight to the Eastern Cape. Like, it's brutal.
It's hard
it
work.
It is brutal.
And by and the way, I think it's also often, worth saying, you've never said horrible things about John in my presence, and we talk a lot offline, as the kids say. I've never had a problem with him personally. I think he's probably quite a fun guy. If he's like your mate, if you were at school with him or whatever, I think he's a nice guy to know. He's certainly intelligent. He's certainly capable of a lot of really good and impressive things. And for a while, I think everybody was, I remember when he was chief whip of the DA, you remember what a good job he used to do then in Parliament. He was superb.
And that's the conundrum. So I don't have any hate for people because that sure. like you just give them energy and power, which is not worthwhile. But if you speak to John on a normal basis, he is one of us. Like he sort of believes the same things we do. We can talk about international politics or geopolitics. Like he just gets stuff. But there is a chronic lack of self-confidence at the heart of it. And he is very susceptible to pressure with people he trusts or people that he likes. But when the DA says, listen, John, you need to get rid of this, Roman Kabarnak, he would always do it instead of just standing up for the principle itself and say, it's my decision, I stand by it, give it 6 months, we'll see how it goes. But he's very quick to pressure. And you can see that in the FMD response as well.
I think that's fair comment. And, again, I don't think you're talking out of turn here. We're all allowed, if you run for a public office, if you're a politician or you're an actor in a movie, people are going to want to talk about you. You're public property in some way, shape or form. And again, I have no axe to grind with John, but I am curious about how the DA works, because we already know that the ANC is just a big criminal syndicate, right? And we know that everybody in the ANC is kind of on the take in some way, shape, or form. And we've just accepted that. But I don't know that many South Africans, especially people who vote for and support the DA, I don't know how many of them know actually how it works. And you had some insight into that. And I think it's right that South Africans know how that party works. And of course, people will say, oh, well, you're going at the DA and they're a good opposition party, and they're competent, and there are some incredibly good people in the DA. I won't take any of that away from them. But I don't have to hold a candle for that party. So why don't you tell us what you discovered about the way that it works and what people like Tony Leon, Ryan Kutsia, so many others on the federal executive of old and the new one have to do with how it all works? Because it might give us insight into how these other ministers, the newly appointed ones as of this week, and the ones who've been in office from the last election, how they actually operate.
So, I mean, I have to say this, I still don't know how the DA actually works. I don't know if anyone actually knows how the DA works. There are so many different councils and people sitting on different councils, but what is obvious to me is that there is quite a lot, there's an influence network around the party that's not necessarily in it. So someone like Tony Leon, for some reason they love Ryan Kutsia, who is an expert in failure, in my opinion.
Because he worked with the Liberal Democrats in the UK, who've hardly been like shining success stories. But tell us who this guy is, because clearly he has an inordinate amount of sway and influence within the DA, and he's also unelected. He's never stood for office, right?
Yeah, correct. So he worked in the DA in the 90s under Tony. Apparently quite effective. I'm not too sure his position. I think he was chief of staff or something like that to Tony. He left the DA and he moved to London. Then he did some of the consulting work for the Lib Dems, where they lost the most seats in history at a election. And then he did a lot of propaganda work for the CCP when they took over Hong Kong. And then, I believe, I'm speaking under correction, but I think his company bought Bell Pottinger after they collapsed completely.
Wow.
Or bought into the structures. He was involved there somewhere. So he's a very good sort of PR political consultant, always seems to have
spin doctor.
To do. Spin doctor. That's like ANC has Chris Vick and the DA have Ryan Kutsia. But I haven't, but I mean, his first fatal flaw is that he's on X and he's just unbearable, like just smug of notes, which is not a great look. And secondly, I just don't know what he has brought to the DA that makes him so trusted by even the new leader of the GA, Jordan Hill-Lewis. He's brought in to oversee the effectiveness of DA ministers. Okay, but you've never been in public office in a real sense. You've never been elected. You work for people who pay you. You don't have any real principles as a spin doctor. And that's the essence of the job. This is not a critique. This is the essence of the job. You can't have principles. You take money from the CCP and the Lib Dems and the DA. And that's fine. That's part of the job. But to be like the sort of moral virtuous person where, oh, we want South Africa to work for everyone and the DA will do it. I just don't see the results of having someone like Ryan Kutsia there at all. And he was very shitty with me. We had to go to these meetings for all chief of staff in terms of how to be a chief of staff. I'm like, okay. And he's just like, as soon as I got him to the call, there's all the other DA chief of staff. As soon as I got on, you can just see like his expression change completely. He doesn't talk to me directly. It's like the Keir Starmer effect. It's like, what are you doing here? And how did you get to this position? You have the character of like a dead frog,
there seem to be a lot of people in politics who fail upwards. I'm sad that you were one of the few who failed outwards. So, okay, Roman, we're going to move off of local politics because there's so much other stuff I want to talk to you about this morning. But just quickly, you live in Joburg. Do you want Helen to win as mayor?
Absolutely. Without a hesitation. Absolutely. I'm very selfish. I've got property here. I've got businesses here. I've got assets here. Let's make Joburg, worth living in. It'd be a shame for it to just die. But yes, definitely. The numbers aren't looking great for an overall majority, but hopefully a coalition. I think ANCDA will have a coalition. She'll become mayor through that coalition, and it'll be the GNU at a local level, which is not the worst option.
Okay, and she's managed coalitions before, even very fractious ones, so...
Yeah, much more than the ANC. And I think the ANC actually want that coalition as well. So that's positive.
All right. So you tweeted out something this morning. I just want to read it quickly or it could have been last night. I don't know what time you wake up. But I thought this was quite cool and it made me want to talk to you about it this morning. South Africa is held hostage by the lowest 10% of the population who somehow have more political protection than anyone else. So I mentioned to Ben this morning, it's easy to hate the rich, the top 1%. Everybody in the world hates the rich. But do you have the balls, the gorm, the heart, the soul to hate the bottom 1%? And
yes,
if you look at the way of the world, I know you do, but I'm just sketching the scenario and then I want you to just unleash, Roman, all right? So if you think about the bad people in the world, in society, in every culture, in every country, it's only a small number of people who make life shit for everybody else. These are the kind of people who steal, who lie, who break, who destroy, who rape, who pillage, who plunder, who have no ethics, no morals. They do the worst things imaginable, and they should be either in jail or, in my humble opinion, be put to death by public execution. But the world is such that we don't eliminate these people anymore. We now have them walking among us. We describe them as being mentally ill or disadvantaged in some way. We create all kinds of excuses for them and infantilize them in society. If we just removed that 1%, life would be measurably better for everyone, as opposed to the idea that some people have that if you take away the wealth of the top 1%, that everyone's life will improve. Absolutely, it won't. So tell me what you meant by South Africa being held hostage by the lowest 10% of the population. Who are you talking about? What does that mean?
It's the people who have no moral character. It's the people who what is the term? The term is when you do things without thinking about the consequences. There's a specific psychological term that exists in life, and for the life of me, I can't actually remember it. But it's the people that are responsible for us having a low trust society. As the people responsible for poisoning state institutions.
They're sociopaths.
Completely. I mean, if you look at, there's a world of difference between like a petty criminal and a real criminal. And El Salvador is the example here. Out of a population of 6 million, the president arrested or executed 70,000 people who were all part of the gangs. That's less than 1%, but it's 0.5%. And El Salvador became the safest country in the world, safer than Luxembourg over the course of 4 years, 5 years.
Yes.
Europe executed, especially England, executed the bottom 1% of men for centuries for petty crime. You stole a horse, chop your head off. Yeah. You kill someone by mistake, chop your head off. Or you go to the army, or you get killed in India, etc. But for centuries, the world has known that the bottom 1% of men in particular hold hostage the rest of society, because the bottom 1% are an intolerant minority that don't care about the consequences of their actions at all.
This is what Jordan Peterson calls the dark triad, eh? It's these people who are narcissistic and malignant and malevolent and will do everything they can to ruin it for everyone else. I mean, bloody hell, man. That's what he's talking about. That's what you're talking about, too.
I suppose so. If you look at the story of that Ukrainian woman who was murdered on a train in America, I forgot her name, Irina something.
Irina.
So her killer... And this is liberalism. Like, her killer was in prison dozens of times, let out on bail, let out on bond. And now, after he murdered her on live CCTV camera, the judge said, oh, he's not fit to stand trial, so therefore we sort of will send him to a mental asylum, perhaps, maybe, we will see. But he doesn't understand the consequences of the actions. To me, if you can't understand the consequences of the actions, that means immediate execution. How are you going to deal with someone if your mental retardation is such that you can't understand the consequences of your actions? You should not be in society at all. Leniency is the opposite. It's an aggravating factor in keeping you locked away or executed. It's crazy.
All right. So you can lay a lot of the blame for this kind of attitude, as Gad Saad says, at the foot of toxic empathy. And it's clearly a problem in Western society, this toxic empathy. But I don't know if you listened to a guy called Matt Walsh. He went on an absolute tirade this week about the insanity defense, which used to be a very rare thing. It used to be something, and you've been a lawyer in your previous life. If you plead insanity in America, it means that you're saying that you're acting without any, not locus standi, you're acting without agency.
Any intention, you
effectively are... You're thinking, you're not thinking, your brain is hijacked by your reptile amygdala response, and you act out of pure instinct, and it's almost under duress, right? And therefore you escape the maximum penalties, and they're supposed to put you in a mental hospital. We used to have asylums, and what Matt Walsh said is that this defense is being hopelessly abused by defendants who are clearly awful, awful people that need to be removed from society in whatever way that, you know, justice system in whichever country finds it appropriate to remove them. But they cannot. They are absolutely positively a negative influence on everyone in society. Everything costs more. Everything is much more dangerous. Everything is worse because these people are allowed to stay in society. What do you think is the reason that we live in a world now where activist judges and people who are imbued with this toxic empathy are allowed to do this against the interests of the majority of people, the common good, the mores and norms of society, which dictate that we should try to live in a place and a time where we're not all imperiled by one or two bad actors?
I mean, civilization is the very high and violent standards of a place, right? So civilization is the application of violence to commit to high standards. And that has been slipping away since the end of World War II in most of the world. And I think it's liberalism. That's essentially what it is. The World War II taught, we took the wrong lessons from World War II, because after the war, especially the intellectual class and the political class was thinking to themselves, how can we prevent this from happening again? What actually took place here? And what they figured out was Germany was a very close society, very proud of their history, and they almost became this very insular nationalist proud nation that believed they could go to war with the world, which they did, or attempted to at least. And then after World War II, what you find, you get a lot of these philosophers talking about the open society. There's a great book. Mm-hmm. This is not my argument, by the way. There's a great book called Strong Gods that is available out there. That's amazing on this. It's written by a theologian, a Christian theologian. And what the open society is actually the stripping away of collective characteristics of a population and replacing them with individual characteristics of each human being. So you neuter the ethnic, class, and historical roots of a people, essentially, and then you make them all individuals with individual rights. And you have an open society, and the open society is about tolerance, and the open society is about anyone in the world, from Afghanistan sheep herder to a Singaporean prime minister. All these people are essentially the same thing. You just need to educate the one more than the other about what constitutes a good life or how to behave, etc., etc. What it fails to understand is if you strip out meaning from people and you replace it with consumerism, what has happened currently, you strip out the capacity for the church to help people. You strip out the capacity of all these other social institutions that existed forever, for centuries, from ever helping anyone, and the state must come in and replace those services. And the state is a bureaucrat and a manager of decline. You got managers in place in the bureaucratic state, not leaders, managers, right? So you have credentialed class going into the state and dictating policies that have very little bearing with how most people actually live every day. So I blame the end of World War II, not because the wrong people won or anything like that, but the wrong lessons were taken from the defeat of Nazi Germany. And the creation of the open society just leaves leaderless societies. And we can see that. That's why Trump is such an aberration for so many people, because rightly or wrongly, and I agree and disagree with him in equal measure, he is a real leader. If he walks into a room, everyone moves to make sure he's at the center of it. That's what a real leader does. J.D. Vance is the same. Putin is the same. Lee Kuan Yew is the same. And you can count these people on two hands. How many leaders have we had since 1945? You know, maybe 10 of them that were actually leaders. The rest were just managers. Thatcher.
Margaret Thatcher. Keir Starmer.
Yep. Correct. And Keir Starmer, Cyril Ramaphosa, Joe Biden didn't know anything. But these people are all managers of a bureaucratic system that are managing decline.
So
the real choice is, the real choice is, okay, immigration is the number one thing in Britain that people want to be implemented. Okay, so how do we manage it? Oh, we put immigrants in hotels. That's managing the wrong thing. Like, just ban immigration. How about that? Then they'll give you all sorts of reasons why they cannot. And they're all liberal reasons. Oh, because the human courts of human rights, and these people are fleeing oppression, and so just being a leader and saying, look, like, fuck these people. I'm on the side of my people who elected me, and that's what we're going to do. But they can't do that because they're liberal.
Yeah, I mean... So Britain's a great example of this, because the bureaucratic class, the management class in Britain, has done everything they could to ignore what the referendum wanted. The referendum to Brexit was completely ignored. They've jumped in and tried every loophole they can. They've danced around it as much as they could for the better part of a decade. And have gone against the will of the people. And that's why you see the rise of people like Nigel Farage and Rupert Lowe. And you know, I don't know whether you've seen this movie, Citizen Vigilante, which was all over X the other day. We'll talk about that in a second. But I just want to quickly pick up on something that you said there in your analysis of post-World War II Western civilization. Judge Clarence Thomas this week in a big Supreme Court case in America, where they were deciding upon the birthright citizenship of Americans, the 14th Amendment, a famous case that was adjudicated, I think, in the 1930s or 40s, about whether anyone born in the United States, just by virtue of being born on the soil, is allowed to be a citizen. And it was upheld by the Supreme Court in a 6-3 decision, but Judge Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito obviously they did not concur with the majority ruling and wrote substantial and I'd say quite worthwhile obiter dicta, which is the legal term we have for, you know, the reasons that they apply to, sorry, the revindicatio is the reasons they reply to they apply to the law, but their obiter dicta is a more of a general discussion of where the law comes from, the history of America, what it means to be a citizen. There's a lot worth discussing and worth understanding in that. And the reason I bring up Clarence Thomas is I think he occupies more or less the same territory as you on this, that it actually matters that you have values as a civilization, that you subscribe to a combined set of principles, norms, values that make the society worth living in. And I wonder about this, not just because I'm interested in, you know, Supreme Court cases in America or in birthright citizenship, but because this is especially relevant in South Africa right now with what we had happen on Tuesday. And we see as a growing issue, it may be the biggest issue when the municipal and local elections roll around in November. The issue of who is actually allowed to be a part of society, what does the society stand for, and who is left out? Who do we not want? Because, you know, obviously citizenship has to mean something, and by meaning something, it has to exclude some people. And that's essentially what Clarence Thomas was saying. He was saying it's a privilege to be a citizen of the United States. It's not a right that is given to you just because your mom flew here on an airplane, gave birth to you, and then went back to Mexico.
It's completely correct. But I was looking at this notion of birth, the citizenship, and it applies mostly to the New World. So America and South America, Argentina, Brazil, and a few other countries there, and nowhere else in the world. My ideal scenario, my ideal country is the UAE. The UAE says you can come here, you can do your business. There's a big means test to determine if you're allowed to have a visa. A means test is how many millions of dollars that you have. You can live here as long as you want, but you have no political power. You would do no politics whatsoever. You don't preach in public about your religion. And otherwise, you will all be deported. That is the best scenario, because you've got high net worth, smart people coming in, creating businesses, creating jobs, having no political power whatsoever. And essentially, it becomes an economic zone for the rich, which is great for the UAE in those circumstances. Yep. But in Britain and Western Europe and in America, you have lower classes, lower working classes coming in to take over entry-level jobs from Americans or Brits or whatever the case might be. And you have entire industries like the food delivery industry or the Uber industry who basically only thrive because people are willing to come in at half the price of a local American to do the same sort of job. And it's treasonous to me. It is absolutely treasonous that you can yank away the ladder from young Americans to get a real job and you replace them with immigrants. Right, so the Mexican can't even speak English when you order your McDonald's or something like that. How is a young American supposed to get a job if they don't go to university because of student loans being too high and all of that? No wonder fentanyl's crisis is out of control, especially amongst the poor white communities. So it really is a civil war between sort of the lower classes versus the lower classes in the West. But in the UAE, it's a competition amongst rich people as to who can accumulate the more wealth and create more wealth.
But then apply the same standard that you're discussing here, which I have no argument with, by the way, but apply that to South Africa. How are we different and how are we the same? And what is your position on things like March and March, for example?
I have a lot of sympathy with them. So it's a bit more, it's not that much more nuanced, but there's a bit of a nuance. Gigi Orcock was on the Common Sense podcast last week. And Gigi Orcock is known as like the White Zulu. He does a lot of business in townships.
Right.
His argument was black South Africans don't care about being Uber drivers or Mr. Delivery drivers because they actually have their own businesses in townships that pay them better. They don't have to pay the taxi fare. And it's all underground, so sales never sees it. They get paid a good salary. They live within this community. The business serves the community. And the real unemployment rate is about 12%, not 35% at this stage. Right. That's what G.G. Allcock says. And I think some of it is quite true. On the other hand, I know people in the security industry, and they say every single organized criminal syndicate is run by foreigners, from Pakistanis to Somalis to Ethiopians to Bangladeshis. The kidnapping mafia, the Rolex gangs, all of that stuff is run by foreigners. And we don't have any real stats on how many people are actually in here, but you can imagine that they are taking the jobs away from South Africans. The spaza shop economy is now, 50-60% foreign, whereas this used to be a South African economy. Again, the same sort of patterns are applying here that they are in America. You know, South Africans are bringing high net worth individuals with investment to create factories and jobs. They're creating incentives for low-skilled people to come in and take over the jobs at the lower and median range. And no wonder there's tension. I mean, it's who should be surprised by this? On the other hand, of course, I'm not for vigilante xenophobic violence like we had in 2008 or some elements of 2015. Mm-hmm. So there are similarities to what is happening in the rest of the world, and I don't see why this should be a surprise to anyone at all.
So what are your thoughts on this new movie, which is breaking records in terms of online viewership? I think it was something like 20 million people saw it after Elon made it available on X, because of course governments in Europe banned it. I saw an interesting article yesterday by Douglas Murray about Citizen Vigilante, in which he says, look, it's a horrible thing to watch, but it should be seen. And like all of us, he's concerned that it may inspire individual bad actors, people who would do bad things anyway, to go out there and take the law into their own hands. But the people who have made it possible for vigilantes to be regarded as the saviors of society because they're not doing their job, judges, police, local law enforcement, those kinds of people are partly responsible. I mean, I'm summarizing him very badly, but what are your feelings on that, and have you actually seen it?
No, I have not seen it. I know the director quite well. I used to be big into movies in the 2000s, and Uwe Boll used to make all
what's
these.
What's his name?
Uwe Boll. Boll, B-O-L-L. How do you say that in German? I don't know. Boll. And this guy's a lib, right? He made these movies called Rampage, which is basically like an anti-white, anti-Second Amendment movies. About white people in America, like shooting things up. Also terribly made, right? So the guy's a sort of shit lib from Germany in the 2000s. Now he's become like a sort of a right-wing guy. So I think he's a bit of a grifter, but that doesn't negate the point I'm trying to make. I never watched the movie. I don't intend to watch it because I know that it would be bad, because a guy can't make good movies generally. But I think it does speak to what a lot of people are feeling and what we've been discussing about the fact that the so-called justice system is not just or legal, or actually cares about the native populations of these countries. And it makes perfect sense in a movie like this, despite it being terribly, objectively terrible in terms of the way it's filmed, the way the story, the dialogue is terrible. Of course it would find some sway with what people are feeling. What is interesting to me is that no one is ever asking the cast members, the non-white cast members, like, what are their feelings about being in this movie? I've seen some scenes where, like, he shoots, like, a whole, like, Syrian family to death because they did something wrong, and it's called collective justice. And no one's ever asking, how come these people are acting in it if it's so bad, if it's so, like, detrimental to their status as whatever they are in Germany, if they're refugees or not, I don't know. But it's weird to me that people can say, this is such a horrible film, it's disgusting, it's ugly. But 90% of the cast is like non-white immigrants. Okay, they get killed and whatever the case might be. But that would be an interesting interview. Not what the movie's about. We know what the movie's about. But the people that willingly went into the movie to be killed off as like these terrible, unclean immigrants. That's a far more interesting story to me. But yes, there is a sense, and I hope I'm not wrong, but there is a sense where we are seeing the end of liberalism as we know it. It's really happening in South America. USAID gets shut down, and 3 years later, like 70% of South America has turned conservative. Maybe it's a coincidence.
By the way, do you see it as being such a direct link? Because I have also witnessed huge sweeping changes. I think there are only two left-wing countries remaining in South America, Brazil and Paraguay.
And Venezuela.
No, Uruguay, sorry. Well, Venezuela is now a vassal state of the United States, whether we believe it's entirely best run thing, by them or not.
Best thing to ever happen to Venezuela.
Sure. But it is interesting, this USAID stuff, because obviously Trump and in the beginning Elon with his Doge office and campaign did a lot to shut off illicit money, American taxpayer money that was flowing all over the world to support all kinds of causes that most Americans didn't know about, which means that you're stealing from people and distributing money that does not belong to you as a bureaucrat to other interests all over the world. In South Africa, we've seen, you know, PEPFAR come under threat. That's a major supplier of antiretroviral drugs for people who in the country with the highest HIV rates still in the world. There are lots of people who need that. And obviously the humanitarians and the lefties come out of the woodwork and say, oh, you're killing people. You know, you're taking away funding from them. But why should the American taxpayer help a South African who's got HIV? Because of either their own fault or not their own fault, bad lifestyle decisions or just pure bad luck. Why should American taxpayers have to fund that stuff? And what kind of knowledge do you have of the sorts of things USAID were doing all over the world to promote these causes, which the populations of those countries clearly didn't want? Because as soon as you remove USAID, they vote the opposite way.
Yeah. So there's no real and direct evidence, but you can, Marco Rubio went to the, I think, the Joint Committee of Senate or whatever the case might be, and said, "Why we close USAID? And we spent like $200 million on, you know, condoms in Mozambique and like on this trans show in Uganda and whatever the case might be. It's like just an obscene waste of money on social characteristics of the lib American." And you're trying to impose that on Uganda, which made homosexuality like a crime, you know, 3 years ago. So it is interesting to me that the overarching characteristics of Trump's second term is really like no more aid, trade, right? What do you have? What do I have? Let's make a deal and let's get going. Same as in South Africa. He wants our agriculture, he wants our cars, he wants a few other things. And in return, we don't want BEE and we don't want people to sing Kill the Boer. Seems quite reasonable. Apparently, it's not reasonable to the people who are in power. And it's a great shame of the DA, just to go back to them, that this thing is still not solved 2.5 years in. If the DA had any balls and any power, this would have been solved a long ago. You can tell the ANC, stop saying Kill the Boer, or don't, you know, whatever. Anyway, it's very easy to solve and it's not solved. So it tells you what the competency of this party
They don't want to solve
is.
It. They don't want to solve it because their political priors are more important than practical real politic. And I'm just concerned, Roman, I hate interrupting you on that train of thought, and maybe you want to carry on with it. But I do want to get to this idea that, you know, there are a lot of lefties in the world who believe that once Trump is gone at the end of, either because he's a lame duck at the end of these midterms, or once he's replaced as president in another 2 years, that it'll all just go back to the old way. Do you think that that's likely?
Trump is the moderate position. Just like remigration, that's the moderate position. And if that doesn't work, wait till you get to the extreme positions. Wait till J.D. Vance gets into power. And I'm backing him over Rubio any day. Rubio is great, but I don't trust his instincts. At the end of the day, he's still a sort of neocon that wants to bomb everything. But Trump is the moderating position at the moment. And if he fails, oh, good luck with what comes afterwards. Because Trump still has boomer instincts. but he's actually a nice guy. He actually likes people. But if you look at JD Vance, the man's a killer. Have you seen his eyes? He's all soft and cuddly. He's got an Indian wife and his son is called Vivek and whatever the game might be, but he's a killer in terms of he knows exactly what he wants and he has far fewer social mores to overcome than Trump. So I wouldn't bet on the moderating factor on the right, but also, and more importantly, there's no moderating factor on the left either, right? The Democratic Social, whatever they call, just won a few seats in New York City. Mm-hmm. Mamdani is an example of third worldism coming to New York City, where he declares South Africa is the model to follow. Okay, you should come visit more often then. But I don't think there's going to be any moderating of this. I think polarization is just going to continue to deepen along the so-called left and right axis. What that means these days is a bit more nebulous than before. But I think Trump, and whoever today you call a fascist, these are all the moderate options for what's coming on the left and the right. And that should be of concern to most people.
Andre has a question here for us. Gareth, what happened to you? Or you always been a racist? Roman can fuck right off and so can you. I only bring up that comment. And normally, normally, you know, it's water off a duck's back and I couldn't give a shit what Andre thinks. But I wonder if we've seen a sea change in the way people are responding to words like Islamophobe, sexist, racist. You shouldn't use this word. You shouldn't use that word. I mean, like, I just get the very clear feeling from ordinary people all over the world that they've had enough of this shit. They're just not interested. Call me whatever you want. I don't care. It's just like, I really couldn't give a shit. You know, the old me might have gone, oh, Andre, let me tell you why I'm not a racist and explain to you as if you deserve that explanation. Mm-hmm. Like now, if you want to think that of me, dude, knock yourself out. I couldn't give a shit what you think.
It's like a friend of mine is quite right-wing, much more right-wing than I am. And if someone says that, he says, listen, buddy, I fuck more black women than you ever seen in your life, all right? So fuck you. It's true. He loves black women. I can't say the same because I'm happily married, but if I could, I would say that.
Yeah, it's like everywhere I see this coming up, I you just want to kind of stop and force the people to read the tea leaves. This is not 2020 anymore. We're not going to be pushed around by your major COVID hysteria, political correctness, cancel culture bullshit anymore. No one is interested in that. No one.
And what people don't know, during everything that happened with me, who are my biggest supporters? My friends in the NK party. My friends.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. I can show you a standing member of the MK party in parliament right now. I'll send him a message and he said, fuck them all, you carry on, you did nothing wrong, you're the best at the job, go for it. What happened to me was white on white violence, just what happened to us right now with Andre. That's what it is. That's just white on white violence. My average black friend or colored friend or Indian friend, like, don't give a shit whatsoever. They find it hilarious that whites are fighting with each other. So anyway.
Tell me about the MK party, because Zuma was photographed with the Guptas in India this week. We've seen, he said he reckons MK will win the next election. Win. He says win.
Yes. I don't know what you want to say. Like, I've got friends there. I'm not high up. I don't know anything about anyone there. I've tried to speak to Jacob Zuma on numerous occasions. Just hasn't happened. But what's interesting about MK is that they're actually willing to talk to a lot of people. I saw, I can't call him Jimmy anymore, Nzwanele Manyi was on Aaron's Ritz podcast, which I found the information very interesting. Wacky ideas, right? Like terrible ideas. Sort of Afro-nationalist with like sort of race communism like mixed together. Like it's completely untenable as a political program. But MK is like a grievance vote from ANC people. Right, you saw what you did to Zuma. We you know, he's our man. You treated him terribly. We're going to give him some power. I was hoping NK would be a very hardcore KZN Zulu secessionist movement. Then I would actually sort of be more in favor of them. But it's very messy, and it appears to be a little stockpile for the Zuma family. And I don't think it has much legs once the former president passes on. And from what I understand, he's not really well health-wise or any-wise. So it's an interesting experiment. I wish they were a bit more strategic. I wish they were a secessionist, especially in KZN. Like that Zulu nationalism is very interesting. It could have been great, but you know, it failed because at the end of the day, it's sort of lefty Afro-nationalism, which is what we've seen before, and it doesn't really go anywhere.
Have you had any updates on your feelings with regard to Russia and Ukraine since we last spoke? I remember that you did a trip. You're the only person I know well who's been to Russia recently, and it wasn't even that recently that you went. But what are your feelings on how that's going? Because at the moment, it's also all shades of gray, right? I mean, we hear about Russia losing some, in some estimates, 1 million soldiers up to this point. The war's been dragging on. Ukraine seems to be making some success stories out of you know, pushing back the incursion in provinces in the east of Ukraine. We hear about the cities being bombed all the time. Clearly, the fog of war has descended here, and it's very hard to tell what's actually happening. Combine that with the fact that we have media that are unreliable and have proven themselves unreliable with respect to reporting honestly on this conflict. Do you have any clarity to give people like me and everybody who's listening and watching?
I mean, I wish I did, but I'm not really. Ever since I left government, I've sort of taken my eyes off of it. But it looks to me like Russia on the back foot at the moment. And you can just compare and contrast, and it's not the same, I understand, but compare and contrast what happened in Iran over the course of 2 months or 3 months and what's happening in Ukraine over the course of 4.5 years now. I mean, it's chalk and cheese. And if you listen to military specialist about how Russians fight. The Russians fight a war of attrition, and it gets bogged down and bogged down and bogged down until they get the upper hand, and they just steamroll their way through to wherever they want to go. I mean, that still hasn't happened after 4.5 years. The calculation is they lost 1 million men, 600,000 deaths, and the rest wounded. I don't think it's going very well for the Russians in Ukraine at the moment. And I'm not certain. I actually really thought that Putin and Trump would have made a deal and told the EU to go fuck themselves.
Yeah,
when they said, okay, well, he could take Donetsk and he could take Luhansk and he could take the Eastern Front, which is basically what he wanted, and then guarantee that they would never join NATO as the Ukrainian state. But that didn't seem to go through, mostly because Putin understands that the Americans can't be trusted for good reason. Very good reason. They go back on their words quite often to their friends and their adversaries in equal share. So I really don't know where it goes. And I'm thinking that no one actually gives a shit anymore where it goes. I think they'll just leave it. America wins either way. If Russia loses so many men over this period of time, America wins. If Ukraine sort of doesn't disappear, America still wins. It's actually better for it to be a stalemate for everyone involved, I think, even the Russians, than for it to go either way at this stage. And that's why I think it is a stalemate. I think it just suits everyone, except for Europe. But it suits America because they supply Europe with whatever Russia cannot at the moment. So I think it'll be a stalemate. And for very good reasons for everyone involved, that's probably the best outcome.
There are a lot of people who I enjoy listening to, watching, have some respect for, because I find their analysis interesting. Many of those people have been vacillating hugely on the Iran issue. And since you brought it up, I think it's also worth touching on this. Some people are saying now that this has been a hopeless miscalculation by Trump and his administration, that the Strait of Hormuz being used as the biggest bargaining chip was something they should have foreseen. They're unwilling to put troops on the ground to finish off the Iranian problem, that just by surviving, the Iranian theocracy wins. Are you on that page, or do you have a different take on how this is going? Because it does have down the road consequences for us in South Africa, you know, cost of petrol, among other things. And we're very much reliant, unlike America, on Middle East fuel. So much of it is controlled through that Strait of Hormuz. Do you have any insights on that? And what do you think the long game is here? Because we can't just look at the midterms, although many Americans will, as the most important consequence of Trump's, in inverted commas, miscalculation. Or do you think there's something else going on?
It's very difficult to parse out. I think it is a miscalculation from my side. I think they went in there and said, okay, if we kill the top echelons, we can negotiate with the second echelons. That didn't work out, so they killed the second echelons and moved on to the third echelon of that society. I read the MOU, and from what my understanding is, J.D. Vance wrote it and made sure that it actually came out. And the MOU is actually pretty strong, the Memorandum of Understanding, which is like to end the war. And if Iran does various things, America will fund the infrastructure funds and stuff like that. It states quite unequivocally that you must stop supporting Hamas and Hezbollah, which I support completely. Obviously, stop bombing Israel, which I support completely. But it's not a clear-cut victory in the way that we think it is, in terms of there's not a defeated enemy, which I think is what Israel wanted. A defeated enemy is Syria, right? Defeated enemy is Libya. It's like a failed state, which I don't want in Iran. Iran's 100 million people. I don't want people to live in a failed state at all, let alone in Syria or wherever. Afghanistan's a separate thing. It's always been a failed state. So that's just the devil's playground. But I don't think it's such a big. It is. No one can civilize that place. It's terrible.
What is Kipling's eponymous line? I'm going to try and recall it as well as I can. When you're wounded and left on Afghanistan's plains, and the women come out to cut up what remains, just roll on your rifle and blow out your brains, and go to your God like a soldier.
Chala, as they say. Yeah, that's exactly what I would do. I think it's what a Russian did. In Syria, he got shot down, and as they descended upon him, they shot down his jet, and as they descended upon him, he took a grenade out and blew them all up. Kudos. So this Iran thing is not so clear cut. My understanding, and this is, people say, I'm an Israeli hater. I'm not, but I think Israel does want to be surrounded by failed states. It does suit it very well. If Syria is a vassal state for American interest, if Iran is a failed state and a vassal state for American interest, Lebanon as well, I mean, Israel wins. It's that obvious to me.
And yet, it has to be said that they've come to terms with the UAE in a way that no one could have predicted post-Abraham Accords and post this Iran invasion. Nobody could have predicted that. Saudi looks like it may be skirting around the possibility of having normalized relations with Israel. Not always the failed state option is the best option for Israel. I mean, in the case that they can actually make a deal with their Arab neighbors, it could be very good for the entire region.
But remember, those Arab neighbors that they extract deals with were Sunnis, right? And Iran was the heart of Shia.
Yeah.
And Sunnis and the Shias hate each other completely. So it's, you have a common enemy, it does work out. But if you have Syria is Shia, Iran is Shia, Hezbollah is Shia,
Qatar
as well. I don't have a definitive answer for you on Iran, but I think it was a miscalculation on part of Trump. I think it did cause catastrophic effects for the midterms. And my assumption was they saw how easily they did in Venezuela. And they sort of wanted to replicate that. And they already thought, from what my understanding is, you kill the top echelon and the people will just rise up. If that is the case, that's very naive. I mean, if you live under a police state for 40, 50 years, very naive way to look at things. Not everyone is like a Second Amendment loving, you know, American. Like people don't just rise up because they get shot. And they've been trying to rise up for many times. And the consequences have been death and destruction. So we'll see long term. I'm not in a position to say it's a failure right now, but it does seem a bit like a capitulation. And I think the Iranians will see it as a victory rather than a defeat, because then it won't become a failed state like Libya or Syria.
You mentioned Bukele earlier, and I do want to just dwell on South America for a little bit, because we have more in common with them than we do with Europe or with Iran or with North Korea or with China or with America, frankly. In South Africa, yeah. we apples for apples, I think we have a lot more in common with Argentina, Brazil, Venezuela. We need to watch what's going on in South America, because it's a bit of a bellwether for what may happen on this continent as states start to determine what it means to be a society, what it means to be a country, what it means to trade with this country and that country and have normal relations with your neighbors. Let's just talk about Javier Milei for a second, because I think Argentina is a fascinating example of what can happen when people vote for the right leaders and when those right leaders take the initiative. So many people, as you mentioned earlier, are just managers in government. They're not leaders. And once you decide to enact sensible, practical rules from the executive down, society tends to order itself towards the good and towards order rather than chaos. And that's clearly happening in places like El Salvador and Argentina. And hopefully we see it happening in, you know, Peru, which had their elections this week, Paraguay, Bolivia, Colombia. What do you take as the lessons from South America, and what do you take as the warnings?
As we mentioned, South America has turned right. I think 80% of the countries, or 70% of the countries that were left 2 years ago, are now right. And I do find that quite interesting. And I think it has to do with the fact that America has pulled out influence from that particular continent. But when you say right, I mean, I'm just talking about normal people and normal policies, right?
Maybe we should. Sure, you're not talking about extreme fascism here. You're talking about center right, moderate stuff.
No. I'm saying whatever right fascist position you think, I think is a normal moderate position. Executing criminals.
Okay.
No, executing criminals. Yeah, 100%. Bombing drug cartels with drones. Great. Go ahead. I agree. So all these things are very normal to me. This is what any leader in any party in history would actually have done. And the fact that we see it as right wing is just an indication of how far we have fallen as humanity itself. I do find it interesting that they have turned right, and a lot of that support came from the diaspora in America. So I believe is it Peru or Colombia, where the Japanese Bolivian or Japanese Peruvian won? I think
Peru,
her name is
Peru. Fujimori.
She won the extra 0.3% because the Peruvians in America voted for her. It was 50-50 all the way through. She was almost losing, and the diaspora in America voted for her. And she's interesting because her father was prime minister and was removed for being too fascist. And she comes in, and she looks Japanese because she is Japanese. But yeah, she's been in Peru for two generations. And it's almost like this Hendrik Verwoerd effect, where you have someone born somewhere else become an extreme nationalist of the place that he adopts at his home. I'm not saying what's great, but I'm just talking about the elements of that. And the diaspora understands that once this country that I left, because it's a leftist shithole, once it becomes great, and this, maybe I'm giving too much credit, but maybe Rubio actually wants this, you actually stabilize these countries in South America, you make them prosperous, and then all those people will just leave America to go back home. Right, I haven't seen any stats on El Salvador, which has been safe and prosperous for a number of years now. I don't know how many have gone back, but I assume quite a few have gone back. And it goes back to the Monroe Doctrine that was discussed about a year ago, where the sphere of influence for America is going to be the sort of the Western New World hemisphere. Except for Canada, that's Satan's playground. No one cares about them. But everywhere down from that, including Mexico, including South America, they remove Maduro so that the Chinese and the Russians can't get missiles, can't get routes for drugs and things like that. This is our territory. Correct, and oil especially. But this is our territory. South America is the territory of America. And it suits them greatly for them to be right-wing, to be nationalist, to follow the same sort of policy that Trump has, and to not do dodgy deals with communists around the world. So maybe it's organic, maybe it's not organic. Whatever it is, I support it. So it makes sense.
Well, I mean, you know, when you talk about commies, I suppose that's an area where there are many of us starting to realize that you can never actually kill the communism. You can kill communists, but you can't kill the communism. It just keeps coming back like a cancer that goes into remission and then survives.
We haven't tried hard enough to kill all the communists. I mean, you know, there's still a way to go. But going back to South Africa, I think this is what we're going to have in about 10 to 15 years. I expect there's these shaky coalitions happening, or two or three or maybe even four election cycles. But sooner or later, there will be a populist that will come and will sweep the votes, will sweep the nation, get 50% of the votes, and just become fantastic and sort and become the king. That's what you want. You want a monarch of South Africa. You don't want a manager of decline like we currently have. And I don't care who becomes the next president, whether it's Corné Mulder or Jordan or Patrice Motsepe, these people are all managers. Okay, Corné's great, but he will never become president. But the rest are all managers. They're all managers of decline. We need a king. We need a monarch. We need someone who actually gives a shit. We need for vote without the racism. If that makes sense.
Okay. All right, there's a hell of a lot to digest there. Dude, it's always so nice to have you on the show, and thank you for covering so many different things with me. I know that we can get into some subjects that maybe you and I are the only two in the world that are interested in, but I'm sure there are people who've benefited from all of these insights. It's great to have you on. I hope you get the money from government. It'll be the best use of my taxes that I can think of, and have an excellent weekend.
Well, thank you so much for having me on. And it's always such a pleasure, Gareth. We should
Do
this more often, and I'm happy to do so. Thanks again. Everyone, have a good weekend. And
keep strong. Thank you. Yeah, and let us know in the comments and share this with other people so we can find out whether they like Ramon on the show or not. Because, you know, you're only as good as your last show, Ramon. All right, dude. Thank you. Cheers.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
All right, Ramon Cabanac, and lots of fiery things worth discussing there. Plenty of food for thought over the weekend. Keep warm. I saw a couple of comments here about how miserable and cold it is. It is cold as hell in Johannesburg. Melissa says it's -1 degree. Fuck. Okay, we haven't had frost yet, so maybe this is the weekend. I hope not. I would prefer a mild winter. But there we go, everybody. We'll end it on the weather, which is a very mundane, satisfactory, uncontroversial subject to end a very controversial show on. And we will see you next Friday for more of this. Don't forget the daily briefing if you haven't already subscribed and you haven't already checked it out. It's still free for a little bit, so you need to get onto that. Bitcoin Butt says, time to listen to the daily report, daily briefing. Yes. Go and do that next. And thank you for joining us this morning. There's no point in doing this show unless you're listening and watching. So thank you for that. We will see you on Friday. Bye.